Hello and welcome to the Beer Nuts Productions podcast. My name is Goff and today I am joined by a very special guest. He has lived something of a colourful life, ladies and gentlemen. He has been involved in politics, he's been involved in the adult industry in many different forms as a lobbyist and so forth and so on, publishing and all sorts of stuff. We're going to learn all about it. It's Robbie Swan. How are you doing today, Robbie?
Good, thanks, Goff. Good, how are you?
Very well indeed, my friend. Now, for those folks who may not have heard of Robbie Swan, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Give yourself a better introduction than what I just did.
Oh, well, that wasn't bad. You know, like, I mean, I guess the first thing to say is I'm 70 years old, so, you know, I've seen a thing or two. Basically, you know, I've been a journalist, just a hack journalist for, you know, a lot of my life. I started off as the, writing stories for Penthouse and Playboy back in the early 80s, or the late 70s, actually, when they used to pay $4,000 for a good story. They don't do that these days. So, in fact, I don't think those magazines exist anymore, not in Australia. But back in those days, you know, they had a lot of money because, you know, they were very popular magazines with very large circulations. And if you could write politics and social issues for those magazines, they really paid well for them because they wanted to balance the, the centrefolds with some intelligent journalism, and it was always the thing that you said you buy it for the articles. And so, you know, the publishers of those magazines knew that, and so they wanted good articles. And so that's where I sort of first started working as a journalist in that area. So, but after that, I started to edit a magazine called Simply Living, which was Australia's premier alternative magazine at that stage in the early 80s. And it covered anti-nuclear issues and environmental issues and things like that. They wanted it to, the new owners of it wanted to make it a lot more political, so they hired me to do that. And then when that was finished, I looked around and thought there was a big hole in the market for political humour and satire. We hadn't had a political humour and satire magazine in Australia since, well, probably, Nation Review or, you know, even The Living Daylights. Before that, the Smith's Weekly in the 1930s. So we got together with a couple of bright sparks like Philip Adams and Richard Neville and, people like that, and we put together a magazine called Matilda, which I think is still in the Guinness Book of Records as the most sued publication in Australian history. I think we got 17 defamation writs in the first year.
Well, I want to actually chat to you about Matilda magazine because I've heard a lot about it, but I've never actually seen it. So could you tell the folks out there a bit more about Matilda magazine, what it was about and why you kept getting your ass sued?
Well, I mean, back in the mid-80s, a defamation law in Australia, I mean, it's still an issue, as people would be reading in the papers today with, you know, Christian Porter, the old Attorney General, and various other people suing each other. Defamation law has always been very controversial, but in the mid-80s, it was incredibly slanted towards politicians. I think Bob Hawke built a $350,000 swimming pool in his backyard with the proceeds of one of his actions, and you know, politicians just made lots of money by suing journalists and publications for saying what was often the truth, you know, but they couldn't prove that the truth was in the public interest. And that was the catcher, you know. If you couldn't prove it was in the public interest to say that, you know, such and such fucks pigs, well, you know, you were in trouble. I think half of Joe Bjelke-Petersen's cabinet sued us, and certainly Bob Hawke did, and a number of really prominent people in society that we, you know, dared to publish stories about. I mean, the thing that got us in trouble with Hawke was that we said that he was having an affair with a woman called Blanche Del Puget, who he subsequently married, and he'd missed a cabinet meeting because he was up on a beach house in Coffs Harbour or something with a. And the idea of the story was not to necessarily reveal that he was having an affair, but was to say that he missed a cabinet meeting because of it. And, his people just got really upset about it. And, they threatened to sue us until we told them that we had the photos. But then, so of course, nothing happened then, and which often was the case. You know, if you stood your ground and you said, well, come on down, you know, I've got evidence, I've got the photos, or I've got witnesses, you know, and all this. Quite often politicians would back off when they knew that they were in the wrong. And, but still some didn't, you know, some went ahead. I mean, I don't know if you recall the dreaded Dr. Jeffrey Edelston. He's still around these days.
Yes, yes. Actually, did he not... I think he might have passed away only a couple of days ago, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yes. The fellow that used to own the Sydney Swans, is that the same? Yeah. He passed away about a week ago.
Well, yeah, just not long after he bought the Sydney Swans team, we published a story that said, you know, the godfather gets a football team or something like that. And, you know, we alleged in the magazine that he was, you know, had been a heroin dealer, I think, and a bird smuggler or something. I don't know. There was all kind of, you know, stuff in there. And his barristers actually did manage to get me into court in Sydney one day in the Supreme Court after many years of chasing me. And in fact, the bailiff came in and found me under Philip Adams' table in 2UE, because I was producing Philip Adams' radio show at that stage. And, you know, I was hiding under the tables so his bailiffs wouldn't find me. And Philip sort of said, "No, he's in here. Yeah, he's under the table, you know, get him out." Philip said, "Go up and face the music." So off we did. And we went to court, and I just happened to have some Costigan Commission documents that actually did, you know, prove what I was saying, the magazine had said was true. And so I did, as we walked in there, Dr. Edelston's barristers were just on the side of the door there. And, you know, I showed them to them and said, "Look, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen these." And they took one look at it and went, "Oh, dear." And went up to the judge and said, "Oh, Your Honour, we'd like to close this case down before it gets started." And the judge went off at them saying, "Well, you know, you've chased this poor man through hell and high water. You know, what's the go?" And so he tore strips off them and the case was just sort of finalised there. But, you know, nothing, it just didn't go ahead any further. The other one...
You go on.
So the other very prominent case was with... a Supreme Court judge in Queensland called Angelo Vasta, who we published an article that said he'd fucked up a murder trial really badly. Well, he didn't like that, so he sued us. And through 6 or 8 months of court case here and back, which, of course, you know, I never attended, and we never represented ourselves, but he just shot himself in the foot with his own evidence. And at the end of the day, he became the first Supreme Court judge in Queensland history to be sacked by the Parliament, because the judges can't be sacked except by the Parliament. And the Parliament realised that he'd perjured himself so badly in the case against us that they sacked him. And so I think he went to jail. Yeah, he did go to jail. And, you know, I remember penning a letter, because he had been involved with his brother Santo Coco, or his cousin Santo Coco, who was a National Party MP up there. They'd been joint owners or partners in a toilet paper factory, and of all things. And I remember after he was convicted or thrown out, I wrote him a letter on a roll of toilet paper and sent it to him and said, you know, "Stick that up your ass," or something, you know, which was the Matilda way of going. I mean, we, you know, we didn't care what people said about us or what, you know, if we believed that what we were saying was true, and we generally, you know, always actually had, you know, good evidence from reputable journalists to say that, we stood by our guns because we had nothing to lose.
And how long did Matilda magazine last? Because I believe it wasn't long in publication. I might be wrong, but how long did Matilda magazine last for?
No, you're right, it wasn't. I mean, it lasted for, I think, 18 months, and then it folded. But it didn't fold because of the writs. I mean, you know, we had ourselves protected very well with a very elaborate corporate structure that had been drawn up by a solicitor here in the ACT called Richard Ashoghi, who's now a Supreme Court judge. And he, you know, just developed this publishing little company structure that deflected those writs. In the end, what happened was that we couldn't, the distributors, Gordon and Gotch, and the printers, Wilkie's up in Queensland, big printers, none of them would print the magazine or distribute it anymore because they were getting sued as well. In fact, news agents were started to be sued as a way of trying to stop us from, you know, from saying things. And in the end, we never banked on that. We never thought that they would go to the distributors and people like that. We thought they'd have more spine than to capitulate and stop publishing and printing the magazine. But in the end, that's where it folded. We simply couldn't get it out anymore.
I see. And now another person that you might have had a few run-ins and dealings with over the years is George Pell. I believe he's not a huge fan of Robbie Swan, and the Catholic Church don't particularly enjoy your work so much. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the reason George Peel did like it was because, you know, I mean, my partner, Fiona Patten, you know, who's a Member of Parliament in the Victorian Parliament at the moment, we ran an organisation called the Eros Association, which was a sort of Australia's Adult Goods and Services Industry Association. And this was probably a good 4 or 5 or maybe 7 or 8 years after Matilda folded that we moved into this area of sort of running an industry association for the adult industry. And, you know, it appeared to us that, you know, that there was a growing number of, you know, priests being arrested and, you know, charged and arrested for, you know, sexually assaulting young kids, mainly boys. And so we thought, look, you know, after a couple of years of this, we said, you know, there's lots of cases here, like there are hundreds of cases. And the public don't really know that. So we thought, well, we'll just put them together in a book. We called it Hypocrites. You know, we put a lovely painting of St. Anthony with a little kid in his arms on the front and published, you know, the court findings of, you know, of something like, I don't know, 300 or 400 priests. And the Catholic Church went ballistic over this because it was the first time anyone had done this in Australia. And not only the church, but several very religious politicians also went ballistic at us and, you know, threatened to stop us from going into parliament to lobby politicians and you know, all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, George Peel was, you know, one of the main figures that we directed this at back in those early days. And, you know, that's, yeah, that was what happened out of it. We got quite a few death threats out of it, serious ones. One was from a priest in a country area in Australia, but the you know, I think it was a special branch investigated some of these death threats and said one or two of them were pretty serious, and so, you know, with a bit of a guard on our place for a while in our house.
Now, another thing I know, and again, I might have this slightly wrong, so please, by all means, feel free to correct me, but you're a big lobbyist and advocate for sex workers and the sex industry itself. Could you maybe chat a little bit about that for us?
Well, yeah, I mean, back in, you know, when Fiona and I first met, she was a sex worker in Canberra, out in the industrial suburb of Fishwick. And, you know, I was a sort of, a hack journalist who, you know, become a lobbyist for the X-rated video companies here in Canberra in the late 80s. And, you know, we sort of met each other through seeing our letters to the editor and articles and stuff like that. And, you know, after a couple of years of trying to put out different fires that were always being lit by the churches to close the adult industry down and close X-rated videos down and just, you know, make sex work illegal, we decided to form an industry association to stop, you know, to give them some credibility and stop that from happening. And and we called it the Eros Association after the Greek, you know, god of love and lust, whatever, Eros. And, you know, we set about, you know, legitimising, in a sense, and, you know, the Australian adult goods and services industry. And so that's where we got involved, you know, lobbying for sex workers to, you know, so that they had a, and brothels as well, brothel owners, but X-rated video people, people that run stripping places, people that ran, you know, what do you call them, those parties, you know, house parties, swingers parties, yes. Went across the spectrum, you know, even mainstream filmmakers who showed R-rated films in their cinemas and stuff came on board, you know, because they were having a hard time from the churches as well.
And what was your goal? What did you want to achieve?
Well, we basically wanted to stop the discrimination that was being levelled at people in this industry. I mean, they were like being made to feel like pariahs when really, you know, I mean, sex workers fill a very valuable role in society. You know, people selling vibrators and dildos and lube and, you know, or, you know, magazines and videos and stuff. I mean, they provide a service, you know, just like a, you know, carpenter or a newsagent, you know. You know, it's a legitimate service. And then everything was non-violent. You know, we're not talking about violent material here. We're talking, which is very different from so-called pornography today online, which is, you know, a lot of it is quite violent. I mean, back in those days, we'd never even seen a violent porn video, if you wanted to call it that. So, you know, we were very happy to lobby for that industry because we thought it's non-violent erotica and what people do in their bedrooms is their own business and it's no business of government to get involved in that, you know. So our hope was to sort of put, you know, standards, you know, make standards and things that the industry could run by, because up until that point they'd never had them. So codes of ethics, codes of conduct that sex workers and people running adult shops could run by, and basically to sort of professionalise the industry. That was our goal, to make it like, physiotherapists or something like that.
And do you feel that you achieved that to a certain extent, or is there more to do?
I think there's definitely more to do on that, Gough. It's a good question, actually. I don't know. It's hard to say when you step back from it, because, I mean, X-rated videos or films are still illegal to sell in the States after, 50 years of lobbying, and when they're all over the internet for anyone to see free of charge anywhere, no restrictions on age or anything. If you still sell an adult film, like a video, that Debbie Does Dallas or something, to another adult, you can still go to jail for it. If you get online and look at and just dial P for porn, you'll get more porn than you know what to do with, and it's quite legal. And that shows up. I mean, that's been the inconsistency and the, really the double sort of the two-faced side of politicians who want to ban this product, is that they've been overtaken by technology and there's nothing they can do about it. But they still maintain, if you go to that adult shop and they're selling you an erotic DVD, you can go to jail. I mean, it's nonsense. It's an absolute nonsense.
Well, that raises another point, which I hadn't actually thought of you could go on the internet, like you rightly say, and you could go and you can watch porn for free. Should that be something, again, in your opinion, where if you're going to watch something like that, you should at least, pay for it so that the actors and the people making it can, receive profits for their hard work? I mean, would that be something that you would be keen to see happen, perhaps?
Yeah, I would. I think that's a huge mistake that's been allowed to happen. But, the problem is that the people who put up all those free films and online are actually making money from them. I mean, some of the actors and actresses in them, or the models, whatever you want to call them, some of them still do earn money for it, it's like a lost leader, if you know what I mean, you find the supermarket selling, avocados for 10 cents each or something, and you think, well, they're not going to make a profit on that. Well, they're not, but they want to get people in the door. And that's what happens in the porn industry as well. And that's, you'll find that, the advertising that lies just behind a lot of those films and stuff is enough to make it very profitable for that. So a lot of those actors and actresses still do get paid. It's just that you don't pay to go and see them. However, what that does in my mind is actually set up it leaves that industry ripe for having material up there that is not in anyone's best interest. Well, that is, it's got violence in it. And, we fought for 25 years to legalise non-violent erotic films, even if they're sexually explicit, which most of them were. The fact is they didn't have any violence in them. And, that was the big thing. If we'd been able to get that in place, if politicians hadn't been so boneheaded as to keep saying, and no, 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 well, I think that would have, it was like pushing a reset button for people's viewing habits in Australia. I think we would have been far less likely to see people wanting to buy violent material or watch it than we do now, because we would have had 25 years of an established practice where people just watched, good old-fashioned, rumpy-pumpy. And but these days, it's appalling. You go onto many of those big tube sites are just, there's a lot of material there that's in, really questionable stuff and should not be allowed on there.
Now, Robbie, some might say you're a reasonably controversial figure, and because of that, I would assume, I don't know, you can tell us, I would assume that, when you contact somebody, for whatever reason it might be, they might pigeonhole you or not want to talk to you just based on their thoughts about you. Does that frustrate you at all, the fact that people might not take you as seriously as what perhaps they should based on what you've done previously in the past?
Well, no, not really. I think I'm over frustration, Gough. I don't really care what people think these days, I know what I do and I know what I am, and, I don't really care. I mean, it does actually, affect you when you're trying to get in to see lawmakers and people like that, to establish, you know, proper standards, and you're trying to, you know, do serious work, and they won't listen to you. I mean, that happened to me with, you know, like people like an independent senator called Mal Colson. He's dead now, but he left the Labor Party in the mid 90s, and you know, became an independent. And you know, I went up there one day and put some stuff on his desk, which, you know, lobbyists are allowed to do, you know, to say we wanted him to support legalising X-rated films. Well, he did his nana. He came out and, you know, threw a whole bunch of papers in my face and called me a scumbag and a filth merchant, and it almost ended up in fisticuffs. I was ready to deck him, you know, because he was such an arsehole. But fortunately, the security people in Parliament House that came forward, and you know, at that stage, a Liberal senator called Chris Puplik stepped out of his office next door and said, "What's going on here?" And I said, "Well, this arse here is bloody just, you know." He said, "Oh yeah, he's like that, you know."
Well, maybe you can give me some advice. So, when with Beer Nuts Productions, we produce comedy films. I think they're funny because obviously I make them, so of course I'm going to say that. But they're comedy films. There's no malice intended in any of them, but they're all full of fart jokes and all sorts of things like that. It's just all a bit of fun. A mutual acquaintance of ours, Ilya, she does all of my artwork for me. So if ever I need artwork, Ilya does the artwork, and it's always hilariously inappropriate. It's just absolutely brilliant. And but I get really frustrated when, for example, a talent agent won't send me talent for an audition because they say, "Oh no, that script is inappropriate." And I get really, I don't get upset, but I get more frustrated and annoyed that, you know, like, it's just a bit of fun. Can we not just relax and calm down? I mean, that's sort of my attitude towards it all. Maybe you could give me some advice.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't dare to advise you. That's an area that I don't know much about. Well, it's been a while since I've been involved in broadcasting and radio. But you know, it's what I say. I mean, I guess, you know, you've got to call people out for being wowsers when they are. You know, that wowserism is a really horrible thing. It's like being it's not like being a serial killer if you're a wowser, but you know, it's like being someone who wants to stop other people from having fun and enjoying life. And I can tell you that there are plenty of people in show business today and in the entertainment and arts industry who got their start from something that was less than, you know, salubrious, you know, who got their start in comedy or whatever, doing something that was, you know, that they would now think, well, I wouldn't do. Like, you know, they might have been a topless waitress or, you know, a stripper at a hen's nights or something like that, but they've worked themselves up, you know, because it's a break, you know, they got a break to start somewhere. And I think people that close you down, like that you're saying they do with you, because they think that, you know, what you're doing might be rude or crude or, you know, not in good taste or whatever, you know, I mean, it's just a really judgmental attitude, a really judgmental way of looking at business, and you know, they're the ones that lose out in the end.
Well, I tend to agree. Your last statement's the best. I think the same thing. They're the losers in the end. But I was more meaning not. I mean, I'm not going to be taking anybody to court anytime soon. I don't have the funds for that, for example. But I was more meaning just within yourself, like those people out there who might be listening, who are trying to make a go of things, and people keep, you know, shutting them down. I mean, you've faced many trials and tribulations over your journey. Can we finish the interview maybe with something like in regards to how your advice to people when people keep, you know, knocking you down, like has happened to you, and slamming the door in your face, how you're able to get yourself back up and say to yourself, no, that's not right. I'm going to pursue and I'm going to continue on. Like, how do you manage to get yourself up and about again after somebody has slammed the door in your face?
Well, it's a good question. And, look, I think this might be a bit serious, you know, after saying all the things I've said before, but at the end of the day, your self-confidence and your self, you know, your feelings about yourself being anchored within yourself is the most important thing. Because if you feel anchored within yourself, it doesn't matter what people say, you know, it's sort of, you're able to just distance yourself from it really quickly and easily, and be separate from that, and know your own talent, and know your own self. So I think it's that famous old saying, you know thyself, is the most important piece of advice you can have. Because if you know yourself really well, And there's various ways to do that. I mean, you know, I was a teacher of transcendental meditation for many years back in the early 70s. You know, that's one way to do it. You know, the yoga's another way. I mean, you know, there's a teacher out there called Eckhart Tolle who practices being in the moment and being in the now. He wrote a book called something, The Power of Now, that's right. Even reading that book, you know, gives you a grounding in yourself that you probably did not have before. And once you've got that grounding, you feel grounded, you can sort of resist anything. I mean, you look at people like, you know, I mean, someone who's been put in jail for 30 years, you know, like Nelson Mandela, you know, who comes out of it at the end, becomes a great leader. I mean, how do they do that? How do they exist, you know, in isolation, like in solitary confinement for 10 years or something, and then at the end of it, they come out of it and they're just integrated people? Well, there's only one way, and that is that they believe, it's not that they believe in themselves, they actually are anchored in themselves and they feel, you know, really, you know, they know themselves really well and they're able to sustain that. And to my mind, that's the way to do that, you know, because once you feel really anchored and you just don't feel blown about by the winds of change and all that all the time, once you've got some stability within yourself and you feel that sort of stillness within, you can handle anything. You can actually handle anything. I mean, I remember, you know, being busted for growing 600 marijuana plants back in 1970. And, you know, I'd just taken a big acid trip before I got busted. And so, you know, I was thrown in Queanbeyan jail for a week, you know, with a full-on acid trip in my head, you know. Like, and I remember thinking at the time, you know, Jesus, it doesn't get any worse than this. thinking, well, if this is as bad as it gets, it's not that bad, you know. Like, you know, there's some old drunk next to me, you know, vomiting on the floor. And in those days, you know, the Queanbeyan jail was a mess, I'm telling you. You know, the one blanket and a piece of board to sleep on. But it wasn't bad, you know, because, you know. Anyway, that's my advice to people. Know thyself.
No, I love it, Robbie. Now, we've gone way, way over time, but I do want to thank you very much, Robbie. You're a fascinating human. I could chat to you for hours. I really could. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and sharing your wealth of knowledge and your experiences. I really do appreciate it.
Good on you, mate. It was nice to be with you. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that does bring us to the end of this episode of the Beer Nuts Productions podcast. Oh, I should also ask, very rude of me, Robbie, if people want to know more about Robbie Swan, where should they go? What should they do?
Look, you know what? Probably the best thing is to buy Fiona's biography. It's called Sex, Drugs and the Electoral Role. And there's a whole chapter on me in that.
Well, yes, go on.
There's a few chapters about how Fiona and I met and how we did the Eros Association together and all that. So that's probably the best background that you'll ever read, you know.
Absolutely.
It's on goodreads.com at the moment with 4.5 stars. So people obviously who read it really like it. So, you know, I'd recommend it.
Absolutely, absolutely. We'll go out and get to – what's the title of the book again for us, Robbie?
Sex, Drugs, and the Electoral Roll.
Well, get your ass out onto gear and make sure you purchase a copy of that fantastic read. I have heard from other people, Ilya, for example, who said it was a very entertaining read indeed. So make sure you buy a copy of that book. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, as I said earlier, that brings us to the end of the Beer Nuts Productions podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe, rate and review, leave a friendly comment because that's always nice. And of course, beernutsproductions.com is your one-stop shop for all your entertainment needs. So until next time, we will talk to you then. All right. Did you get that, Scott?